Good morning. Welcome. It's the Ask the Pastor program on the Messenger of Good News Worldwide, KFUO. KFUO is a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. I'm Roland Lettner. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to Pastor Spomer for that lesson in the fifth chapter of Luke. We went through the first 11 verses. If you didn't get a chance to get in during that hour, you can certainly do so now. We're glad to revisit that text. But then anything new, anything that's been of interest to you, things in the news, things you may have heard in the sermon yesterday at church, who knows, maybe something as interesting as they dug up and finally found King Richard III. Joining us is Pastor Charles Hendrickson from St. Matthew Lutheran Church in Bon Terre, Missouri, and
Redeemer Lutheran Church in Potosi, Missouri.
Potosi, how are you? Good to see you again.
I'm doing all right.
You look fit and ready.
Thank you. I'm trying to lose a little bit of weight. I've got a big birthday coming up in about a month.
Well, they're all big.
This will be my 50-10th birthday.
50-10th birthday?
Yeah.
The big 6-0?
Yeah.
Wow. So that's what I'm going to look like in 9 years.
If you're lucky.
Lucky. Well, yeah.
So I'm trying to get down under 230 by my birthday.
God bless your efforts. Progress. It's not easy. It's not easy. It's
exercise. Exercise is the key.
You got to cut back on the ice cream socials at the church.
Well, we got a potluck dinner coming up this Sunday.
Do you?
Yeah.
Celebrating what? Or just a good old get-together?
We often have a potluck dinner on the fifth Sunday of the month. We didn't do that in December, so we said, well, we'll tack it on to our voters' meeting in January. Well, then we had some bad weather a few weeks ago in January, so we pushed it off till February 10th. And so that's what we're going to do. Hmm. And so we have a potluck dinner and game night a few nights a year at St. Matthew and Bon Terre, and we invite the people from Redeemer and Potosi and anyone else who wants to come.
So if you're sort of mid-St. Louis County, how long does it take to get down to?
From my house, well, I live at far south St. Louis County. It takes me 40 minutes. I get on at Merrimack Bottom Road and I-55. Takes me 40 minutes from my house to St. Matthew Bon Terre.
So not that bad of a drive.
Yeah, I do it a few times a week. I try to combine visits, meetings, services, all that stuff, Bible classes. So I'm not going down there every day. I do my office work. I was just doing office work over at Einstein's as I was waiting. I got my Einstein's coffee here. So I'm doing service planning. I'm trying to get all my service planning done through Lent and Easter.
You know, that's the beauty of technology now, because so long as you've got a cell phone and you've got an internet connection by Wi-Fi somewhere,
yeah,
you got an office.
It's great. I have a mobile office, yes.
Yeah. So you are a student of history. We've talked about this mm-hmm. on other appearances here on the program. Richard III, they have confirmed it. Richard III, some would say the usurper of the crown of the Kingdom of England at the time. It says here that Richard was killed in battle in 1485. He's going to be reinterred at Leicester Castle. Now, this is what was interesting, because there's been some mythology about how he came to meet his end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it says that there were 10 wounds that they could find on the skeleton, including 8 to the skull at or around the time of death. 2 of the skull wounds were potentially fatal. 1 was a slice that removed a large flap of bone from the skull, and the other was by a bladed weapon which went through and hit the opposite side of the skull, which was more than 10 centimeters, which takes me back to fatal.
Potentially fatal. I would say that's a good potential.
That is fatal. I mean, even today, I would say that would probably be, 99.9%
it would not do you
fatal.
Too well.
Yeah. Other wounds included slashes and stab wounds to the face and the side of the head. There was also evidence of humiliation injuries, including a pelvic wound, likely to have been caused by an upward thrust of a weapon through his hindquarters.
Ouch.
So they did not treat the remains of Richard III very well. Do you think that was fair? For those who are wondering who was Richard III, you want to?
Well, I mean, he's immortalized, I guess, in Shakespeare's play.
Yeah.
And known for having like a crooked frame.
Yeah. The scoliosis was there in the frame that they found. The DNA testing is
coming
back.
Weren't they digging up like a parking lot or something in England and found this remains and said, maybe this is it.
And he was just thrown in a hole.
Hmm.
No shroud, no nothing. And they said from the position of the hands, he was probably, and this is where some of the mystery comes in. Was he alive? Was he captured alive or killed in battle?
Well.
And they said it appeared that the hands were still tied.
Doesn't make much difference now.
No, it doesn't. But I thought that was interesting because, you know, of the history there. It's,
okay.
We keep, much like with, you know, biblical archaeology and scholarship, we tend to have these people out there who say, this is how it was, and then the evidence pops up.
Yeah.
And you're amazed at some of the things that were accurate and some of the things that were absolutely inaccurate.
You know, I took a trip to Israel some years ago, and I remember at Caesarea by the sea, they had found an inscription that actually indicated Pontius Pilate, the one mentioned in the creed,
the Pilate Stone,
was the prefect or governor at that of the region at the time.
I want to play for you next a little story that I came across early last week, and I thought it was just one of those sort of kitschy throwaway stories.
Okay,
and it caught fire on the web. It hit local news media like crazy. And now you've got news sources like Fox and Friends this morning was dealing with the story. And this is the story about the pastor who went to Applebee's. Are you familiar with this?
That was right here in St. Louis.
It was here in St. Louis. Now, this is this morning. This has been going for about 10 days now. Here's the story as reported on Fox and Friends this morning.
And that's where we find our next story, in Applebee's. And when it comes to tips, I wear khaki, and I lived on tips for a lot of years, and I feel for the waitress in this last story.
Sure. And in fact, we're going to take you out to St. Louis, the Applebee's in suburban St. Louis there. And apparently a group of eight. And remember, if it's a group of eight or more, they automatically tack on an 18% tip. But a pastor, of all people, was in charge of writing the credit card receipt. And here it is, heard around the world. There's the pastor, Alois Bell. And on the receipt, you can see she writes, I give 10% to God. Why do you get 18%? And then next to the actual tip, there's a zero, although now that it's hit the fan, she and the other people at the table say, you know, the 18% was on there, plus we did leave other cash.
They say that they left us $6.29 on the table, and she regrets now having written that. Here is the pastor.
I'm looking at my bill, and it was like 18% gratuity. And I was like, oh, man, I just said it out my mouth. I give God 10. Why should I give you 18? I'm sorry that I wrote it. Just dumb. It was dumb of me.
Well, here's what happened, Brian. The waitress who was their server said, hey, that's pretty funny. Showed it to another waitress by the name of Chelsea Welch, who took a picture of it with her phone, then posted it online. Then it ricocheted around the internet. Next thing you know, the pastor called the Applebee's to complain about the server. Chelsea Welch, who simply took a picture of it, she got fired. And now she's horrified that she would get fired over just showing what
evidently
happened.
Evidently she wrote as a caption, I'm sure Jesus will pay my rent and groceries. And she said she posted it as a lighthearted joke. But now Applebee's is down one fine waitress, and a pastor is sorry about the whole incident. You know what I say?
What?
Don't leave an additional tip. Let them do the math. Give them the 18%. No more notes. And walk away.
That's right. That's
and you would know, formerly working at Bennigan's, you would know all about that. And look where you ended up.
Right. With waitresses, alligators, and the U.S. National Guard. So it's fantastic.
That's right.
I know. All right.
Now, the reason I played that for you, Pastor, is I found the story last week. I put it at the bottom of the stack, figuring it's one of those two-minute things. You know, you're at the end of the hour, don't want to get into anything heavy, so you bring that kind of up and you throw it out there just for kind of quick consideration. But this has gone across Europe in the European media. Mm-hmm. It's gone across the web. It's hit a number of websites and now network news programs. What do you think it is about this story, and why is it catching people's attention?
First of all, I think Alois Bell wanted a lower bill.
I think you're right.
But I think
now there's a headline, folks. You need to hire this man down at the Post-Dispatch.
I think what caught the attention of people was a pastor. I think that's the hook here, is they want to jump on pastors as though this is, you know, anytime a pastor does something stupid, and she admitted it was dumb.
Oh yeah.
Whenever a pastor does something dumb or stupid or even immoral, that'll fetch headlines. So they want to make this representative of pastors. I'll say this. We have a Tuesday pastors study group that meets here in St. Louis. We go over the Greek of the coming readings, and then we talk about sermon ideas, and then we go out for lunch. And there's quite often more than eight of us.
Yeah.
And if the restaurant tacks on a gratuity, I mean, we pay it. We don't write snide comments on the receipt. And none of us, I think, are really highly paid.
Now, what's interesting is it's not the waitress who received the note, but one of her coworkers,
yeah.
Chelsea.
That, now, there's enough dumb to spread around between Miss Bell and Miss Welch and the Applebee's, which, by the way, is in the city of St. Louis, not the suburbs of St. Louis. It's at Chippewa and Kings Highway, I think, that one.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been there. So I think there's enough stupid to go around in this story.
Well, it seems that most of the attention has been diverted from the pastor to Applebee's firing the waitress.
Well.
And that this was somehow just, oh, it's one of these innocent little things.
If you're an employee, I don't think it's a good idea to use these social media to, even if the customer deserves it, to make a customer look bad. Even, you know, it doesn't bring good attention to the Applebee's, so whether they should have fired her or reprimanded her, I mean, some people are a little too touchy.
Well, I'm just surprised that even you heard it in the Fox report, that they speak of the waitress in sort of glowing terms.
I don't think there are any heroes in this story.
No. Just
so
gracious. But like I said, I marvel at something that I found last week that I thought was just a quick throwaway for two minutes.
Yeah.
It's national and global news.
Look, I think the other thing is everybody can identify with, everybody has an opinion about tacked on tips, even if you think the waitress or waiter didn't do a very good job.
Well, it's commonplace.
Everybody will talk about tipping, and the fact that this so-called pastor wrote these comments on the bill, and then everything about it, people will have an opinion on.
So I can be rude, and God will justify me.
No,
it won't work that way.
No.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO at KFUO.org. Here's John about women in combat.
First of all, let me say, I think women have enough combat in the home with their husbands.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah. Hope you're wearing your helmet, John. This is a touchy subject for some.
I understand that, Roland, and that I could be kind of shaking the cooking pot here a little bit, I guess, for lack of a better term. Boy, that come out wrong. it was a discussion we had at a church, actually, the other day and yesterday, and basically the discussion through the pastor and things of that nature come through that it was a travesty that the U.S. government, that they're allowing to do that, as it upsets God's law, God's plan of things. I, as a former military person, was very knowledgeable of and seeing of the ladies in the military. Of course, they were a non-combatant role at that time. And I'm thinking that this trend that we're going into the direction of we're all, you know, non-gendered,
interchangeable. Yeah.
Gender non-specific. I think
Thank
is the term
you.
You're looking for.
Boy, that was the word I was looking for, and I couldn't get it out as well as that. I think it's going to cause a problem in our country if it hasn't already.
By the way, John, what part of the country are you calling from?
Illinois.
We're in Illinois. Southern Illinois?
Central.
Central, okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm from Illinois, originally Chicago, but our speech patterns are a little bit different.
Yeah.
So,
I'm more southern.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I grew up in the city, so it's a little different.
Right. I'm in the Springfield area.
Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the question is about women in combat.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I mean, we can look at it from the biblical perspective. We can look at it from the civil perspective. The first thing that comes to my mind biblically, the first thing is the story of Deborah in the book of Judges. And It really was not to the nation's credit that they had to rely on women to do the fighting for them. Mm-hmm. It was actually a mark of shame that a country has fallen that far that they let their women do their fighting for them.
Yes, that was a position that we were explained the other day, yes.
So the second thing I think of is God created men and women to be different. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, a lot of these things like homosexual marriage and mm-hmm. Interchangeability of men and women and so forth, I'm reminded of the story of the emperor's new clothes, where nobody wanted to say, emperor, you're naked. You know, it should be so obvious. Mm-hmm. But everyone was afraid to say it. And I think that's right. The culture we're in now. Look, men and women are built differently.
Yes.
You know, I'm like 6'3", and, you know, I'm almost 60 now, but I mean, I would be much stronger than just about any woman, even in her prime. There's just no comparison in terms of upper body strength in all physical aspects.
Agreed.
So if you're going to, I don't even want me defending my country. I'm past, I got too many, I've slowed down and I'm out of shape and I got aches and pains. So, I mean, it should be guys in their physical prime who can carry the packs and run and do all this stuff. That's mm-hmm. why armies throughout history have, in any culture, have chosen those guys to do their fighting. That's why professional athletes are guys in their 20s and 30s.
Right.
Because they're at their physical peak and they can do more physically than anybody else on the planet.
Yeah. Barring the deer antler spray, you're right.
Yeah. So it just is stupid. It's really stupid from that aspect. Because, I mean, all right, make them do the same amount of push-ups and pull-ups and marches and all of that.
Now, you know they don't.
They do not.
I was talking with my good friend, Dr. Tim Furnish, who's down in Atlanta, and he's one of the Islamic experts that we bring on some of the other programs here. Mm-hmm. But he's an ex-Special Forces guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, you'd go on these marches, and about a third of the way in, most of the gals had collapsed.
Yeah. Not all guys can do this.
And what's, you know, and what's the major screaming at them? Pick their stuff up and help them. Yeah, and the answer was, we can barely carry our own.
And I've read stories of women who say, you know, I got shin splints and I got, you know, they really get banged up more than the men do.
Yeah.
Right. The standards were, even 20 some years ago, over 20 years ago, actually, when I was in, was there were two different levels.
Well, that doesn't make sense because this is about life and death. Mm-hmm. And it's like with firefighters, you know. If there's a gal that can carry the ladder and the hose the same as a man, well, I guess if she wants to do that, I suppose. But I don't want to lower the standard. Now, what they may do is lower the standards for everybody, in which case we won't have as fine a fighting force as we would otherwise.
Well, you know, Pastor and John, father of two girls.
And I've got a 17-year-old daughter. This came up last night. My wife and I were telling Anna, you know, you may have to register for the draft next year.
Exactly. That's one of the directions this is going. But I've had to have that conversation with my oldest, who at the time of her confirmation was really getting into Scripture and studying theology and really grooving on being a Lutheran. And the question came up, well, could I be a pastor? Mm. And the answer was no.
No.
Theologically, now what I've said up to this point, reason can tell you that.
Sure.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we get into theology, God designed men and women differently, just all around. We're not interchangeable, mm-hmm. and it's even a picture of the relationship of Christ and the church with husbands and wives, about one being the one doing the giving and one being the one receiving. And this is why also we don't have women pastors.
Right.
As well as the expressed prohibition of such in the New Testament. So both from the standpoint of reason and observation and nature and the design of our bodies, as well as insight we gain from Holy Scripture, I think it's a dumb idea. It's not good for the morale, and I hate to think of what would happen to those women if they got captured by the enemy.
Exactly. This here, I'm afraid, Pastor, and Roland, that this is just, it's more of the downward, and I'm not putting any women down in any way, shape, or form, but this whole entire this whole entire society, I think, is unfortunately on a more liberalized downward trend. I just think we're in for a mess.
And it's going downhill faster than I realized. I mean, just this past fall with the gay marriage referenda and the marijuana referenda, I mean, it's accelerating. And Mr. Obama just said, he came out yesterday, I read, and now wants the Boy Scouts to allow homosexuals.
Yeah, but they've drawn the line. No atheists.
Oh, okay.
I'm not kidding. The Boy Scouts are holding firm. Homosexuals, that's one thing. Atheists, no.
The problem with that, again, is, it's just, biblically based. I mean, it's sinful. It's, it's point blank. Allowing them into a, I was in the Scouts years and years ago, of course, and allowing that entire change of demographics is another travesty, and it's, I don't know, I don't know what the answer is, but, that was just my comments. I'm sorry to take up
some time. No, that's fine, John.
Good to hear from you, John. Let's grab another call from David quickly here before we have to go to the break. Same comments, David, or something else to add?
Before the break, I guess I'll be controversial, but, I'm back in the 70s, guy. I was a hippie and all that back in the 70s. And, hey, women have been screaming for equal rights. I got so sick and tired of hearing it. Even in my workplace, they wanted the same amount of pay, but they couldn't do the same work. And so I figure, I used to have a girlfriend. I said, yeah, women want equal rights, until there's something that they can't or don't want to do. And the thing is, enough men have been spilling their guts for decades in wars. I think it's about time, let the women do it too. And it's not always about strength. It's about pulling a trigger or about being trained to use a weapon. It doesn't matter if you're strong or not. They can sit there and pull a trigger or a grenade launcher or a tank buster. It always just got to me that they scream that we're just as good as a man, but when it comes to proving it, I'm saying, hey, let them go for it, because they want it. All the Jane Fondas, all the other feminists out there, now's your chance. We'll put you in the front lines and see what you can do. And that's all I got to say. I know I probably opened up a hornet's nest, though.
No, that's okay.
We'll see. Thank you, David.
I can sense your frustration. Again, I would say, can they meet the same standards? But this is a religious program. We're not just a political, social program. So I think what we're talking about with the moral decline in the country, going back to the Boy Scouts thing, and the homosexuals, is how this impacts the church is when you have removed the concept of sin in a culture, it makes it that much harder, indirectly, to preach the gospel. If there's no sin, why would people need a savior? So this is why, our main job in the church is to preach the gospel, but we also have to be able to preach the commandments.
And with the Health and Human Services mandate, we've seen the government willing to encroach into freedom of worship, not freedom of worship, free exercise of religion. They're converting it now to freedom of worship. There could very well come a day when we have this gender-neutral absolutism that may be going on, that they're going to come to the LCMS and go, you will have women pastors. It's just another job like every other.
Or I would have to be forced to perform homosexual marriages.
Yeah. And then,
I wouldn't do it.
One day the Romans woke up and the place was on fire and they went, how did we get to this point?
Yeah, really.
Who invited all these Germans down here? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO@KFUO.org. We'll be back in just a moment with Pastor Charles Henriksen. Stick around. Good morning. Welcome back. It's the Ask the Pastor program on the Messenger of Good News Worldwide, KFUO. And we were having a discussion about women in combat. And I should also give a tip of the hat to Kathleen, who wrote in. And as you mentioned, Pastor, her comment was, we have to consider also the possibility of POWs. But, you know, been there, done that. First Gulf War, you know, there were prisoners taken. Second Gulf War. It's, you know, women are in combat right now, whether we like it or not. They're just not active combat. You know, they're not deployed as part of the SEALs or part of the, you know, airborne or whatever the case may be, but they're close enough to the action that for all intents and purposes they're getting mortared like everybody else. Mm-hmm. You know, we have women coming home from combat that are missing arms, missing legs, you know, that are being killed.
Yeah, nothing against, I have absolutely nothing against the gals, the women that are doing that. I just don't think it's a good idea for any country to put their women in harm's way at the front lines.
Well, let's leave it with this.
Okay.
More than one commentator has said words to the effect that a nation that sends its women to war is not a nation worth defending.
Yeah, I wouldn't. That's stating it very extremely, but I mean, I take the point. So let's talk about something else. I'm worried my 17-year-old daughter, you know, if.
You know, I don't worry about that because I've had some very frank discussions with both of my girls about what's right and what's wrong in life. And, you know, the thing is, if you're fair and honest with how you discuss it and you use God, because both my kids have been catechized.
Mm-hmm.
And for lack of a better term, that stuff works.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you, Pastor, not that you don't know that.
Yeah.
But if you do that faithfully, you don't have problems with this kind of stuff in your home. It really works very well.
What do you want to talk about now?
You're just not going to let me keep going there. 505-7850. Now, you know, if the callers want to go there, we're stuck with it.
Come on, worldwide 505-7850.
Listeners. 1-800-730-272. See, you should write to him about women in combat.
No.
No?
So, well, I was just telling you during the break, I went to this hymn writers conference last week. That was very good. They had a little contest for people, the Synod did, to submit hymn texts. And they picked 30 people to go to this conference, and I was one of them, and because I'd written some hymns.
Ah.
And it was a very, I mean, this was like the best, first of all, the chapel services we had were the best singing you could imagine. I mean, because these were all people who love hymns.
Well, professional singers, I would think.
Well, not professional, just people who love hymns.
All right.
And so we had some great presentations by some of the leadership. And
was Fritz Bowie there?
Fritz was there. Yeah. John Vicar was there. William Wheaton was there. Peter Reske. Stephen Starkey, who's written so many good hymns in our hymnal.
Now, in front of you, you've got an LSB on the table in front of you there.
Yeah.
Flip to the very last hymn and tell me what the number on that hymn is.
All right. You're going to talk about the additional ones, right?
Well,
or 966 is the last one in the book.
966 hymns.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No, not 966 hymns, because it starts with hymn 331.
All right, so 660-odd hymns.
650,
what, 50 some, whatever. Why do we need another hymn? Don't we have enough?
The church has always written hymns. People have all, I mean, throughout history. And because language changes, because cultures change with their styles of music, and because people just have an innate urge as Christians to glorify God and express the gospel with poetic imagery and language. That's why there are always hymns. And some of the, you know, hymns that were fashionable in the 1800s maybe are archaic sounding now, don't ring true to our ears. Also, there are certain gaps. And Pastor Starkey has done a great job in that, filling in gaps like with readings for Sundays where there isn't a good hymn. So that's another area where we can fill in some gaps where maybe there's a story in the Bible that doesn't have a good hymn to go with it.
So was there a theme or a trend in these new hymns that you detected?
A lot of them are going to the like the gospel accounts. There's one by Herman Stumpfli about the raisings of the dead that Jesus did, and he's got one for each of the three. Some of the biblical accounts, I think that has served well as bases for new hymns, taking on some hymn tunes that we didn't have, particularly for 19th century sort of American folk. English, Welsh, Irish tunes that Americans feel very much at home with. That's another source. Look, another reason for new hymns, and really there's been a hymn explosion in the last 50 years in English. Think about 100 years ago, that was our first English hymnal in 1912, the Evangelical Lutheran Hymn Book, in the Missouri Synod. Prior to that, we had the Kirchengesangbuch,
right,
which you would do fine with, Roland,
yeah,
auf Deutsch.
Yeah.
But and a lot of those hymns were translated, the Luther hymns, the Gerhardt hymns. But our synod was looking about for hymns in English for the coming generations. And so they took in, kind of like the Trojan horse, maybe some Methodist hymns that weren't as fine theologically,
yeah,
or even just even by musical standards, because they were already in English, or some of the translations of Luther, or particularly Gerhardt, the second greatest Lutheran hymn writer. You know, Catherine Winkworth did some good translations, but maybe she left out some stanzas that had to do with the sacraments. There was not very many at all hymns written by Lutherans in English at the, you know, in our history. That's kind of a new thing. And so with Lutheran theological instincts, writing in English with, you know, the poetry fitting English very well, that's been a reason for this explosion in English hymnody.
Now, this may be a bit pessimistic on my part, but a guy who deals with spoken language all the time and does a lot of reading, English is really a crummy language. It's so dynamic. I mean, what's a dude today wasn't a dude in the 1800s, you know, and what was cool then ain't cool now.
Well,
we
don't use the word dude in hymnody.
Well, you should try. It's a chance. It's like using the word nunc. Go ahead.
You got to use words that are appropriate and have somewhat of a timeless character.
Mm-hmm. But do any words really have timeless character?
Well, they could last at least 30 years or 100 years.
Well, right, generationally, then.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let me take an example of Earth and All Stars that's in our hymnal.
Right.
I mean, going to high school in the late 60s and college in the early 70s, this stuff about loud boiling test tubes and the classrooms and all that, the style of the writing of that hymn is so, it's to me, it's dated. It screams out 1970.
Sure.
All right? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the tune is okay. In fact, the writer, Herb Brokering, has written a couple other good hymns, I think, that do stand the test of time. And, in fact, that tune with, there's an Easter hymn with that tune, and I think that works pretty well. But that one is an example where it got dated fast. And so that's the case with hymns. Some will stand the test of time, and some won't. So, we'll see which ones last and serve the church well.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO at KFUO.org. When you write a hymn today, I don't know, what's the what do you see as the trend in church music? Is it just inevitable that, much like the pump bellows were replaced by the electric blower motor on the organ, that the organ's going to go the way of history and you have to write these hymns for different instruments that wouldn't be considered traditional?
I think the organ works very well as an accompaniment for the congregation's singing. I'm not totally opposed to other instrumentation. In fact, there's that one Tanzanian Easter hymn in the hymnal. It's a very catchy Easter tune. I forget the name of it. But we've sung it in our church, and I've actually played the drum on it,
yeah,
like a little bongo drum that goes with it, and it's very uplifting and rousing. We've got a guy in our congregation now who plays the guitar, does very well. There are some hymns. Now, I'm not talking about like a rock concert. That's a different spirit, a different
style. Yeah, that's not what I was getting at. I was just,
but you know, different instrumentation can accompany congregational singing in different ways. Flute, brass, timpani, some of the services I've heard here at the seminary chapel where they use that kind of instrumentation. It depends on your physical space also and the abilities of your group to sing.
Well, just in terms of cost of maintenance and initial installation, if you build a new church, to put an organ in, it's a very expensive prospect.
Well, nothing will beat a pipe organ, but yeah. I mean, most of us now have to settle for an electric organ, but Some of those can sound all right. Yeah.
Hmm. So what you wrote? What hymn?
I've written
most
several.
Recently. I mean, did you perform any?
Well,
you were
let's see. What did I submit? What did I submit for this contest? I submitted one called "A Lonely Monk Now Long Ago Nailed Truth Upon a Door." It's a Reformation hymn. I wrote one on the synodical theme of witness, mercy, life together, and written several others. So I haven't done a lot of hymn writing up to this point, frankly, because there wasn't much of an outlet, because I missed getting in on the hymnal project for LSB. So yeah. I was thinking, well, it's going to be another 20, 30 years before they need more hymns. But, you know, I think now that the Synod is encouraging these hymn writers, there may be some outlets for this with supplements or choral pieces and so forth.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Got a little bit of something in the news here I'd like to bring up with
okay.
you, because it goes to ethics and how we think about things today. In the news this past week, other than the Super Bowl, was the 10th anniversary of the shuttle Challenger,
yeah,
you know, coming apart and killing the entire crew.
Was it Challenger or Columbia?
Yeah, it was Columbia. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Challenger.
Challenger was
the
first one. Yeah, that was. So this was the Challenger, and here's what has been revealed now that really wasn't brought to light. If you followed the story, you know where I'm going with this. NASA's top officials wrestled with what they thought was a hypothetical question. What should you tell the astronauts of a doomed space shuttle?
Hmm.
All right. And apparently they were just too overconfident about the heat shield being preserved in spite of being struck by ice and other debris that damaged it on the wing irreparably. It let hot gases in, which just literally caused the shuttle to disintegrate.
Did they know that at the time, or are now they thinking about how to handle that in hindsight?
Well, the question, no, they knew at the time that there was a possibility.
Yeah.
But they couldn't bring themselves to acknowledge it. They were affirmed that their technology was sound and that the heat shield, even though damaged, would still protect these astronauts. So they didn't mention it to them at all.
I read this story the other day. One of the first things I thought of was, now, if this shuttle was in orbit, could they have sent up, like the Thunderbirds marionettes, up another vessel to link up and transfer the crew to the other vessel? I'm wondering if they had a fallback plan to have.
Well, the AP wire copy story here that I have says that what they've learned from this experience is that you should never give up, no matter how hopeless. And at that time, with this shuttle, apparently there was a sense of hopelessness, that they were just affirmed that there was nothing they could do anyway. If it was a dire situation, as it turned out to be, don't tell the astronauts, because they couldn't have gotten another shuttle up in time. There was no way to do it. And really what they were faced with, sort of like with Apollo 13, if you saw that movie.
I remember the actual event, Roland. Yeah,
well, I
didn't see the movie, but I remember the real-life thing.
But most people go to the visuals from the movie with Tom Hanks, where they moved heaven and earth, and these engineers didn't sleep for days, and you've got a roll of duct tape, you've got a cardboard box, and a small canary. Build me an air purifier. You know, it was that kind of a challenge. That they'd sort of resigned themselves to the fact that, nothing was going to be salvageable here, but they didn't want to leave a space shuttle in orbit, running out of air, ultimately with 6 or 8 dead astronauts on it, just waiting to retrograde and burn up into the atmosphere.
Hmm. Yeah, what do you tell them? I guess an analogy would be with a terminal patient. I think if they say, I would at least tell them here's what we think. There's a damage in the wing, and there's a real danger of overheating. We don't know if you're going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real possibility you may not make it. So make peace with your God, quote.
Well, see, now that would be the thing that would strike me, is that that's sort of grossly unfair. Now, I assume that if you're an astronaut, you assume that there are risks.
I think that.
So you're probably in that mindset
to
start with, but still.
That's the most dangerous thing, I guess, is the reentry through the because of the heat buildup for even a ship in good shape. So,
So the damaged heat tiles that were broken off when they launched it. But the one interesting quote here is that after they started flying again, after they did the Columbia investigation and, the sackings were had, when NASA started flying shuttles again, according to the AP copy, NASA was told by its team of mission managers, "We are never again going to say there is nothing we can do. There's nothing we can do."
Mm-hmm.
So they're readopting the Apollo 13 model, I think.
You know, they're not doing shuttles anymore, but yeah.
Yeah, I think we go to the Russians now.
I don't know. I don't know what's next. Mars? So,
the Chinese, I know. The last thing I heard about NASA was they did some massive laser projection on the moon where they did some picture.
Okay.
And the thing, you know what that's going to lead to?
Tang.
Pepsi. Tang, yeah, all those sorts of things. Hey, here's another little something that I pulled. This is, you care much about guns in church? Does that interest you at all?
Not really.
Not really?
I'm not a gun guy. I'm pro-Second Amendment, but I don't have a gun, and I'm not interested in guns.
Look at this here. Let me play this for you. Now, this is kind of interesting. This deals with Quakers.
I'm more concerned about cell phones in church, frankly, Roland.
Cell phones in church? Why is that?
Because they ring during the sermon.
Oh, boy. Well, what about screaming babies?
That's all right. I'd rather have the screaming baby than no babies.
Well, this is a story about a fellow. What is his name here? Let me look at this. Here's the headline. Divorce reasons. North Carolina man Warren Pegram blames Quaker Church for his divorce. Here, listen to this.
Spoke with Pegram this evening. And, Lindsay, this is certainly something you don't hear about every day.
It's definitely a different one. Warren Pegram says says getting a divorce at 74 years old is different than when you're 40 years old. It's harder to recuperate. And for him, that's financially. And that's the reason he has a lawsuit against his church.
30 years. We got married in 1982, December the 24th. This is a Christmas present.
The Pegrams, Warren and his wife, Sherilyn, both members of this Snow Camp church.
I really enjoyed my time at Cane Creek Meeting.
Now, that same church is who Warren Pegram blames for he and his wife split, and he's suing them for it.
They want to punish me because I would not associate with the relationship between her and the meeting's employee, their pastor.
Pegram say his wife was responsible for 60% of the household bills, and he struggled financially since she's moved out last February. He says church members were the ones to help her move out.
I think the church had a great deal to do with it. I won't say that they were 100% for it, but they certainly made it happen because I don't think she could have moved out if the church hadn't helped her. I mean, they provided all the people to move all the stuff.
This husband says this lawsuit isn't about affection. It's what he calls financial assault.
I sued them for $180,000 plus up to $10 million in punitive damages. Because churches just should not do that.
A man suing a church over his wife leaving him. It's a case not heard that often.
That's really fascinating. I would love to know more.
Never heard that one before. I'd like to know more, but who knows?
Pegram knows that, and that's why he isn't going to get an attorney.
You have to understand, suing a church is not a feather in the cap of any attorney.
But this husband is saying his prayers. He wins his case.
Well, I think I have to.
Now, we did talk to the pastor on the phone. His name is Pastor Mark Tope. He told us he's been a pastor at Cane Creek Meeting of the Society of Friends for 9 years, but other than that, he had no comment. The next hearing on this case is scheduled for next week.
Well, what do you make of that?
First, I think I would sue the reporter for lack of clarity. I heard the whole thing, and I have no idea why he's blaming the church.
Because they helped her move. A group of friends got together. This woman apparently decided to divorce this man, and they all showed up. She asked for help, and they said, sure. And they showed up at the house, took all of her stuff, and moved it somewhere else.
I thought it was something more than that.
No.
So
That's all the church did.
I'd say case dismissed. I mean, this is flimsy. Yeah.
Well, but I mean, it just goes to the attitude we have now about
litigiousness, yeah.
Suing church, you're going to blame church. Let's grab a quick phone call from James. What do you say? James, always something. Proverbs 15 this morning is on James' mind. James, how are you?
Good morning, Brother Roland. It's actually Proverbs 16 and 25.
No, it says 15 on the screen. We've talked about this before. We only do what's on the screen, James.
There is a way that seemeth right unto a man whose end is death. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, and Proverbs 16 and 6. I'd like for you to tell me what these two passages mean and maybe a proper understanding and application.
Both verses
16 and 6 and 16 and 25, please.
All right, let's start with chapter 16, verse 25. I'm looking at the NIV, but my memory recalls the KJV. There's a way that seemeth right unto a man whose way is death. The NIV has, there is a way that seems right to a man, but in the end it leads to death. I think that's fairly self-evident biblically, is even going back to the Garden of Eden. Isn't that what original sin is? That's what all sin is that we make our own decisions about right and wrong, and you know, it may seem right to us, but it ends in death. I think that verse is describing all sin in a nutshell. That's the first thing I think of. Now, your other verse was Proverbs 16, verse
6.
And I'm reading the NIV, through love and faithfulness, sin is atoned for. Through the fear of the Lord, a man avoids evil. All right, now, taking the whole counsel of God, we do not have in ourselves love and faithfulness that atones for our own sin. It is the love and faithfulness of Christ, the perfect man, the Son of God in the flesh, who atones for our sin through his faithfulness. And finally, in this hour, we're actually getting to speak the explicit gospel. Christ, the Son of God, comes, and through his love for us, God's love for us, and God's faithfulness to his promise, our sin is atoned for. Now, in a human perspective, I suppose you could say that when we make mistakes or mess up, you know, that through our good behavior, we can atone for them in a before men. But before God, only the sacrifice of Christ, his righteousness, his love, his faithfulness, through Christ's death on the cross, fully atones for our sins. And then the next part of that verse says, through the fear of the Lord, a man avoids evil. The term the fear of the Lord is a comprehensive term in the wisdom literature of the Bible. It encompasses, I would say, both law and gospel, both fear of God's judgment and wrath, and also devotion to God that is born of faith, but also takes sin seriously. And through this fear, love, and trust in God above all things, as Luther explains the first commandment. I think that's the concept here in Proverbs about the fear of the Lord. And so because of the Spirit's leading, we will want to avoid evil. I don't know, James, if that addresses your questions.
Yes, it helps me kind of focus a little bit, because in my reading of 16 and 25, it seems as it was making sin some sort of unintended consequence. And in my reading of 16 and 6, it was close to your analysis, where I believe the fear of the Lord is the respect of the Lord. And it would say that if you have mercy and truth, is some sort of a spiritual cleansing agent. And the respect of the Lord, with the respect of the Lord, one can depart from evil. So I really appreciate it, Pastor, because sometimes I get cattywampus in the way I look at these things.
Yeah, the only thing I would add there is in the love and faithfulness, to make sure that, you know, our love and faithfulness atoning for our sins is only secondary. I mean, the real cleansing comes from Christ. And we should live lives of love and faithfulness and avoid evil as Christians, but that doesn't save us. Only thing that saves us is Christ's sacrifice. Thank you, James.
And that reading of 16 and 25, mine says, there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end is the way of death. And I guess that's where I got that some sort of unintended consequence of sin.
Well, I don't think most people, when they sin, intend, okay, now I'm going to die and go to hell. But, I mean, that is the consequence. I mean, Adam and Eve weren't thinking that when they took the bite of the fruit there.
So the devil doesn't make me do it.
You are responsible. The devil will tempt you, as we will hear very soon on the first Sunday in Lent about temptation. But you are culpable for your own sin.
Thank you, Pastor.
Yeah.
Thanks, James. Good to hear from you today. Have a great day. Well, guys, that's it.
Okay.
That's a good hour. I appreciate that.
Hey, let me invite everyone. If you're down a little bit south of St. Louis, the churches that I serve are St. Matthew in Bonterre and Redeemer in Potosi. You can find the website stmatthewbt.org and redeemerpotosi.wordpress.com.
And perhaps someday in the perhaps not too distant future, hymnal supplement with some of the work of Hendrickson. We'll see. Thank you, my friend.
All right.
All the best.
Very good.
See you guys tomorrow. We continue with more healings in the Book of Luke and more Ask the Pastor. We'll see you then. God bless.
Listen to the Bible Study Monday through Friday at this same time. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for the Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is heard weekdays on KFUO Radio, a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.